Okay, so that was my original title, and then as I was doing it, I realised actually what worries me is that we're building more and more harvesters, and we've seen a number of harvesters in the last couple of days, but we don't have enough fruit for the harvesters to harvest. So I'm going to talk about how we can get more fruit. And this is from the perspective of Paradisic, which is an archiving project that I've been working on. It's now been going for 10 years, together with Linda Barwick, who's over there. As you can see, these are the metrics of what we hold in the collection. It was originally established to deal with legacy data, because we recognised there was a lot of tape-recorded material in languages outside of Australia, and nobody was looking after it. So you can see there's about 6 terabytes of material, and you can see the file types and all that kind of stuff there. The project is collaborative, and we've heard of the problems of collaborative projects, but in fact, ours has been a wonderful collaboration, and it's been going for 10 years. There are linguists and musicologists involved, and we have 3 universities. And that's been quite useful, because when one university doesn't let you do something, you just do it at the other university, and you figure out ways around the systems. So the problem is really that we have too little recorded, and this is what we've been talking about. There's too little recorded in most of the world's languages, and much of what is recorded isn't being looked after properly, and we can't even find what has been recorded. So how can we change that? And that's what I'm going to be talking about. So when I say too little is recorded, how do we know? Well, let's just make some assumptions about the amount of fieldwork. So I'm just talking about linguists doing fieldwork, musicologists, anthropologists doing fieldwork. And if we take these sorts of figures, so Paul Newman reported, he did a survey of field methods courses and reported on 34 departments. The LLL conference that ran in 2009 had 180 abstracts. The conference in Hawaii in 2011 had 230 abstracts. So you can see there's a lot of stuff going on. So if we assume at least 100 current fieldwork-based linguistic projects on the basis, you know, of all of those other figures, and if we just go back to 1960 and say roughly 50 a year, then there should be reasonable records of about 2,500 languages. Okay, so this is really ballpark, you know, figures. And when I say reasonable records, I'm talking about recordings, text dictionaries, and since the late 1980s, we should have had digital records and so on. And the problem, as we heard from David before, that even what I call coercive archives, that is archives that have funding attached to them, the two that we've heard about, SOAS and DOBES, MPI, if they can't get all of their grantees to deposit material, how are we going to get the rest of us to deposit material? We don't have the carrots and the sticks. All we have is ethics. We know that that's not much of a motivation. So we need to build incentives. We need to talk about how people should be depositing material. We know that linguists aren't on our own. We're not going to be able to record all this material. We need to encourage, and we've heard some great ideas in the last couple of days about recording by non-linguists. And there are new methods. So the BOLD methodology, which we can talk about later, is an interesting approach, which encourages speakers to record themselves and to create their own transcripts orally. So the whole thing's done orally. There's no writing required. And of course, we've heard a lot about social media as a source of recording and texts and so on. But the problem with all of that is that we have to try and ensure it has some longevity. So if there are reasonable records of 2,500 languages, where are they and how do we find them? Often, this is the way that researchers end up leaving their records, and these are collections that we've had to deal with, some of them. Actually, the top left is just a nice image that I got. We never had found a collection in that state. But, you know, these are collections that have mouldy tapes, and, you know, they're stored in places that we can't find unless we know somebody who knows where they are and all that kind of thing. And, of course, at least those were on analogue tape that lasted for some time. You know, those tapes might have come from the 1950s and 60s. Now that we're talking about digital materials, we know that they have a very short lifespan. And unless we can get those materials into some repository, they're not going to survive. So there are all these wonderful harvesting tools, and we've heard about a few of them here. In fact, I suppose we've heard about all of them here, which is great. They all harvest different kinds of material. none of them in themselves are archives. And what I should mention, of course, an exemplary project that came out of the World Oral Literature Project right here, and this happened 3 years ago or so. So with very little funding and, you know, just a program of having a good idea and getting together with Mark and harvesting material, they produced this index, which I suppose most of us haven't seen because it's tucked away. Yeah. But it's a wonderful thing. And this was done, you know, was available before a lot of these big initiatives and actually has, in some cases, more information than those big initiatives. So it's quite an interesting project. So harvesting existing resources that are out there. And we've heard a lot about the language codes, and this, I think, is the linchpin for the harvesting. So a lot of the harvesting you see there, they go out and they look for repositories that have language codes, and then they can just bring that material into their system. The problem is there are a lot of repositories that don't use language codes because it's just not part of their core business. So state archives, national libraries, all kinds of institutions don't use language codes, so you don't know what's in there from a language point of view. So if we look at the British Library, and I looked up a text in the language that I work on, this is the way that it's recorded, and there is no metadata there about the language except that the, you know, Efate, the island that it's spoken on, is mentioned, and that's not going to find the language. If we look at the National Library of Australia, similarly, you've got Efate language, okay, so that's a bit better, but it's their own thesaurus. If you look at the Phonogram Archive in Vienna, they have a completely idiosyncratic list of language names, and like this. So it's very difficult to find information in there. And, you know, they're in German as well, but it just, it's a problem. So if you wanted to look for the language Lewo, for instance, and you searched Google, you initially get 3 million hits. Okay, so Lewo is a language name from Vanuatu. Searching an undifferentiated search, you get 3 million. If you search for Lewo grammar, 2,200. If you look at the Open Language Archives community, you've heard a bit about that, and I hope everybody knows what that is. It's a harvesting service that specifically searches for language codes. So everything that goes into it should have a language code, and you get 13 hits. And if you resolve down to the hits, you get a record like this. Okay, this is from our collection. And you can see that you have Lewa language, and that's because you have the three-letter ISO 639 code there. And you can resolve from that to the item, and then you can go and look at the object that it's describing. So the problem is that a lot of records that are outside of what we know, and they're in personal collections. There are missionaries, patrol officers, tourists, all kinds of people who've recorded information that we would like to know about. So what we can do is we could create our own catalogues of these items, even if we can't get access to the material. So here's an example. So when we talk about fruit, this is low-hanging fruit. So this is fruit that we could put into our harvest with very little effort. It's a wonderful website put together by the ex-bishop of the Solomon Islands. What he's been doing is keyboarding early manuscripts in languages of the Pacific. And it's you know, Anglican history. This is an example. He has a list of documents in the Mota language. But it's a website. It doesn't have language codes, and it's only discoverable if you happen to know it's there. So what I've done is put records into our catalogue, and I've created a collection which is called external, so it means it doesn't belong in our collection, and I've put a link through to their item. And I've noted down here, this item is not held by Paradisic, but is referenced to allow it to be located in language-based searches. And then, if you go to the OLAC search for that item, you can see that you find that item, and you find a URL that takes you back to that item. Now, of course, you're saying, well, of course, that item is a website. It's ephemeral. So what am I going to do when that website disappears? Well, the great thing about the web is that there are bits of it that are no longer ephemeral because we have the Internet Archive. So if you find that same website in the Internet Archive, you now have a persistent location for that website. So putting the persistent identifier of the website into your catalogue bypasses the problem of the transience of that website, and now we actually have quite a robust index of that item that hopefully will persist. And you can resolve down to the level of the item itself. And here it is. And you can see it's at the Wayback Machine, the Internet Archive. If you don't know what the Internet Archive, I'd encourage you, if you don't know what it is, I'd encourage you to go and have a look. It's, you know, one of those wacky Californian ideas. The guy decided he would just collect the web every 6 months. He'd go and get everything off the web and put it into a huge bank of computers. So we need a shared infrastructure in which to locate our own recordings to make them discoverable, and we need to be able to provide standard descriptions that can be located by standard search mechanisms. And we need to be able to do this before we forget the metadata, so not at the end of our research lives, but in the course of doing our research. So what we've been doing, because we've been observing researchers having trouble getting metadata into the archive, we've started developing a tool which is now called XCite 9. It used to be called Field Helper. And the idea is that you should be able to create metadata without too much trouble. It's set up as a file browser, which I'll show you. So it's a very basic idea. You have a file browser. You designate a directory on your laptop. And any time you do fieldwork and you put files into that directory, it harvests the metadata from those files. It knows about what's in them from the internal metadata, so it knows it's a JPEG of a certain resolution or a WAV file or whatever. Anytime you put new material in, you can refresh that directory, and it refreshes your left-hand panel there. You can then assign characteristics in the right-hand panel, and these could be anything you want. So you could have clan affiliation, you could have the name of speakers, you could have locations, or you could have a set of characteristics which are given to you by the archive you want to deposit in, and then you drag and drop your files over to those characteristics, or you select them, and it then underneath, it's creating an XML file which has the metadata which you then submit to the archive with your files. So you don't have to do a lot of form filling in, and it should be relatively painless. You can add, as I said, any metadata category you want. So this tool is in development at the moment. We're in agile development, which means we have sprints of development every 2 weeks, and hopefully sometime later this year, in the next few months, we'll have a tool that you can download and play with. Another tool that we've been working on is called Aeopus. Now, this is the other side. It's saying, how can we put the material out in ways that can be accessed, and especially interlinear text together with media. So interlinear text being a form of text that linguists like creating. It's a nice representation of text because it shows the complexity of the language. It's not just putting subtitles in, which are just a single line. And it uses the normal workflow that linguists... It takes material from the normal workflow that linguists use, and we've heard about that from other speakers today too. Transcription with Elan, interlinearization, and then you can just upload these files into Aeopus. So Aeopus looks like this. I can't show it to you working because it doesn't run on this browser, but it works and you can go to the website and play with it. It lets you play media. It uses HTML5, so the media is just sitting in an open browser. And it uses all the wonderful characteristics of HTML5. And we talked about how, or David talked about how media, we should be using media in a more nuanced way, and now with HTML5 we can basically use media the same way we use text. So we can interoperate with points in media in a way that we couldn't when it was all flash media and things like that. So there's a lot of possibilities now for the way that we can interact with media. So we have playable media, we have some metadata, we can do a little concordance keyword in context of whatever's in there from that particular language. We can turn on or off the morphemic view, so you don't have to see all the interlinear stuff if you don't want to. It has a reference down to the morphemic level, so if you have a persistent website, you can reference these things down to the morphemic level. So in theory, this then becomes quite a useful research tool, because when you give a presentation, you could just show any of these chunks and play them, either time chunks or morphemes. And the great thing about them is that they're putting stories on the web, and stories are good for researchers, but they're really good for speakers who like seeing this stuff. And, of course, the underlying data should be stored in an archive. This is a representational form. And I think that's an issue that we really need to be clear about. And when Cecilia was talking too, you know, we can create lots of things that we give people, But that's not the archive. I don't think that's the archive's role. The archive's role is to look after this stuff into the future. You can make really interesting, wonderful things to give people, and you could put them back in the archive. But the representation is separate from the long-term storage version. So with that EOPAS system, there's an underlying database. You can select everything that comes from a particular language. And then ideally, which this is the dream part, you would have an interface, and you would have a number of these different stories from all around the world. You'd be able to harvest them. And when Google came around last year asking what they could do, I suggested they could do something like this, which would add fruit to their harvest, and they weren't interested. So in the end, we need to persuade linguists to create research data properly, which is no mean task, and to deposit their material in archives. So we need to create incentives. Now, the incentives are creating tools that make it easier, but we, as an academic community, also need to build recognition into our profession that creating collections like this has some academic merit. And this is happening. There's been discussion about this, and I think we can do it, but it's up to us to do it. We need to locate existing digital material and incorporate it into principled online catalogues. So if LCAT were to allow us, perhaps, to enter this kind of information, it would be one way of doing it. But at the moment, LCAT is acting more as a harvester and not as a data source. And we also need to locate analogue collections and digitise them and get them into this whole sphere of discussion, because if they're still sitting in somebody's drawer, they're not going to be any use to anybody. And ideally, we would have little snippets of information for lots of languages. And at the moment, we have sort of density of information where somebody's worked, and we may have some example texts in that area. And the sort of stuff we saw from the students earlier from SOAS is interesting in this too, that you could have little snippets of information from lots of languages for relatively little effort. So that's my talk, but I just want to leave you with an advertisement for the journal, Language Documentation and Conservation, of which I'm the editor, and it's an open source journal. If you don't know about it, I'd really encourage you to subscribe to it. It's got lots of good stuff in it, and it's exploring how journals can operate in the open access space. So we also have articles with media attached to them and all that kind of thing. So please, if you haven't, go and have a look at that. Thanks.